Welcome to the Leadership Trap Podcast, recording live from Austin, Texas. In this podcast, we explore the conditions that lead to surviving and thriving in a successful leadership role. We examine the traps that can cause leaders to stumble, bumble, or get ambushed in ways that may or may not be of their own making. I'm Dr. Chris Petrafka, and with David Hewen of Austin WorkNet, we have a conversation with each leader that explores the traps they've encountered throughout their leadership journey. Hopefully, it brings a new perspective to your role as a leader and helps you navigate your own way through the traps. You're listening to episode one of the pilot season featuring Ron West, business consultant, former high-tech executive, author of the book Corporate Caterpillars, and the founder of the Chrysalis Code of Leadership Program. Thanks for joining us. Let's jump into the trap.
Looking forward to our conversation, Ron. I was thinking through your broad, immense experience, which includes working with larger international companies, very large ones, well-known ones, and smaller entrepreneurial companies as well. And I'm curious to know, do you find in your work that the criticality of CEO tone is as significant in that large international company as in small ones?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me on the show. Really appreciate it. The most interesting thing, I think, is it's like the answer to most of these leadership questions. It depends. So I've seen small companies where the CEO had very little impact on the culture. It kind of took on a life of its own. There were so many other strong characters who were very well aligned that the CEO kind of took on a different kind of role and was really doing all the fundraising and so had a different persona, and that was fine for outward facing. And frankly, she was a little dangerous on the inside, so they just kept her away from everybody. But I've seen like super large companies where the CEO has a dramatic impact. I remember one in England, he took over the company and started doing a blog of all things because they had like 24 sites around the world, something like that. He had a massive impact on that culture. And within 12 months, it was absolutely aligned to his thinking.
And at the time, that was probably unique to do the blog, I would imagine.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that was very clever. But I'd love to hear more about the horror story of the person that had to be sectioned off.
Oh, of course you would.
Yes.
And I know our listeners would love
change
that.
Names to protect the guilty.
Drama. To protect the guilty. Unfortunately, yes. There's more than one tale of those. What's kind of interesting about that story is that at first blush, she seems just very driven, very powerful. And of course, that's one of the traps leaders fall into. They get so sure of themselves, and she was like, I have all the answers. And her answers were about 20 years out of date with everybody else.
And
Everybody knew.
Including the board? Or was the board removed enough to where they were still believers?
The board were following her.
Okay.
So that was a setup there. So it was more about, well, let's give her a role she can do, which is fundraising, and let's make sure everybody else kind of gets the job done and we'll translate. And you find that in a lot of companies, small and large, if there's a layer of just protection, like just a boundary between, well, here's where the work gets done, and here's some other people that are essential in the leadership role, and there's a buffer in between.
You may want to circle back on that notion of the board CEO dynamic and where that fits into the success of running a company and how CEOs artfully manage board relationships or unartfully manage that.
Or if you just get sent into a fundraising role, you know things are bad.
Yeah, potentially, or it may be that you are so brilliant at representing brand and a next stage technology that you need to be out there representing that because it's so compelling and you're one of the few voices to it. Possibly, giving them the benefit of the doubt there.
Well, one more story, a smaller company this time, a software company. Interesting thing about this one was the leader, this time a guy, and a very similar kind of story. He was great at fundraising, but he also had new ideas. Like every time this guy took a shower, he changed the direction of the entire business. And there wasn't such a good interface between
Was there a water pressure issue?
Yeah. I was like, I love where this is going.
picturing water fountain suddenly
that's
not
good.
Working.
Everyone was just so happy when he'd be out on the road, you know, doing his thing and raising funds, and this was all great. But whenever he came back in the office, there was, you know, everybody would take a deep breath, like, oh, here it comes. And he'd call a meeting, like, this is vital. We need to respond to this opportunity and take the entire company off to left field. And so everyone got kind of used to that. Like, okay, that's him. But we're going to carry on doing this kind of skunk works and get this thing done anyway. So they're almost working against him.
Mm-hmm.
That's insane. After about 5 or 6 rounds of funding, and he still hadn't realized, he just closed that up completely and started the whole thing over again in the building next door. So, yeah,
that's brutal.
Always work out.
No kidding. I can sense the brutality there. So let's back up for a moment, talk about you. A rich and varied background, senior leader up through and including CEO, multinational company experience, now more recently leading organizations through change, through leadership development, and an author as well. The most recent book that's out there is Corporate Caterpillars. Tell us a bit about that book.
Well, I barely had the name established. I grabbed some websites and then got a company, a lot of attorneys at a particular company contact me and got me to give up all my websites. So I'm very pleased that I remembered to put an S on the end of Caterpillars. Otherwise, it wouldn't be called Corporate Caterpillar.
Well, what company could that be?
I don't know.
I'm confused.
Rather not say. The interesting story about the
thinking
book
of doing some construction work suddenly that dawned on me.
Right.
So I first graduated as an engineer a long time ago. And I was an engineer for about a week. The boss decided I was not cut out for engineering and put me in charge of
all
the
that
team.
Education.
Yes.
And what's happened since is that's when the real education started. I've only been in leadership roles for my whole career. So what happened with the book is I started a journal and started jotting down some ideas for a book I had when I first graduated. And I kept starting with a new journal and a new nice pen. Every year or so, I'd start the book again, thinking, well, I don't quite know enough yet. And then finally, I was ready for Corporate Caterpillars. I actually pulled all of the old journals out and studied them. I was going to take all of those great elements of wisdom and turn them into something. And realized that was just giving me writer's block. So I disposed of the journals and sat down and started writing. It came out in about 6 weeks, actually. I realized its time was nigh. It's ready to capture what is transformation. What does that really mean? How does a company transform? Well, it transforms when its leaders transform. So I wrote down everything I'd learned, at least to that point, about how a leader sets themselves up. How do they get real about their situation? How do they develop even awareness? How do they begin to break this problem down? How do they find purpose? That kind of thing. So the whole book is a blueprint, if you like, for transformation.
And the metaphorical representation of caterpillar is?
Well, of course, the whole process, the transforming process of caterpillar to butterfly. And it blew my mind, I think, when I first discovered they exposed caterpillars to a particular smell and gave them a small prod at the same time. So it wasn't very pleasant for them. And they learned to avoid this particular smell. They let them go full term and turn into butterflies. They tested the butterflies, and the butterflies were sensitive to the same smell. Pretty cool stuff. So there's a lot of things going on in transformation, but what you don't do is leave behind all of the traps that were catching you out early on. But it is definitely the only way to develop yourself as a leader and be open enough for the kind of change that we need to see in leadership roles these days.
So we call ourselves the leadership trap, and you had alluded as you were describing the elements of the caterpillar to butterfly.
Love buffalo.
I must admit that looking right behind Ron, this is a visual. There's the Buffalo Trace bourbon that's...
it's always handy in case of emergencies.
Always handy. Right. And we haven't had to break the glass covering yet and open it up. But if we need to, we will. So the caterpillar to butterfly conditioning leads to traps along the way. And so we're naturally curious to know where our guests find themselves in leadership traps or have found themselves in leadership traps. So as you reflect on your experience over the years, especially as a leader or guiding leaders, is there a significant trap moment that comes to mind that had a profound effect on you and or the organization?
Yeah, it's interesting. After you guys kindly invited me to the podcast, give a little bit of thought to, okay, so how do I talk about these traps? And as soon as I started thinking about it, wow, there's actually rather a lot of traps. It's almost as though you come upon a forest, and you're pretty clear where you're going, but you're looking down. And as you're looking down, you don't notice that the terrain changes. And you're pretty sure you're still just putting one foot in front of the other, so you're still making progress. You're not quite sure where you're going anymore, though. You also haven't noticed that actually there's some of the trees are not in good shape and could well fall on you, but you're not really noticing the trees. You're also not noticing you're actually surrounded by a huge amount of wildlife. And as you get further into this rough terrain, there's more and more dangerous wildlife out there, but still, you keep going, pretty sure that you're on a worthwhile journey with great purpose and meaning. And then, of course, the weather changes, but you're under the canopy anyway, so you barely notice that. You stick your coat on and trudge on. And after a while, you don't notice, but there's actually quite a few man traps in this particular terrain, and they're fur-lined, though, and not so mean. So although they're getting set off, and they're catching your ankle, you're dragging them along with you. So you're not noticing, you're not making very good progress. And you haven't noticed, you've been going around in a circle repeating the same lessons that you've learned over again. And it's not until you come across the wise coach, of course, that you realize, oh, so actually I'm not making much progress. So I wonder, is it the man trap or the weather or the dead tree, or the wildlife that's the trap? Or is it the whole terrain that we're sitting in that's really the trap?
Yeah, I think it comes back to what's the system we exist in, right? And I see that so much. And with the leaders that I work with, the environment, is that it's a little bit of all of it, right? And I think that we tend to just as humans, we tend to naturally focus on one particular variable, one particular issue or challenge, without seeing and understanding that it's a whole system of traps that are in there. Because it's easy. We look for the quick fix. We look for the quick person to fire. We look for the quick team to dispose of. And then we still end up with the same results 6 months later. And everybody else tends to see it.
Well, let me play with that for a moment then, if I may. So in your work, you're in part there to facilitate change individually, collectively, right? The facilitator's there to make things easy. They're the outside force. They bring perspective, best practices, and so forth. And you, I've seen you in action. You do all those things. I'm curious to know, if someone has been leading for 15 or more years and they lock into a style that's behaviorally them, and you are brought in to coach either the individual or programmatically coach a number of leaders, what do you do with the person who's pretty locked in? That they may be a willing participant, but those behaviors are so ingrained. Can you make a profound difference in those cases?
It's that famous answer again. It depends. The interesting thing is, if a leader is even partially open, then they're going to be able to hear the feedback eventually, if it's delivered in the right way.
Yeah.
If they're not open at all, it's very, very difficult. So some of it really depends on their situation. It can well be that they are, for example, their great success is continuing, so they feel no real drive to change. It could be, though, that they're not doing so well. And so a lot of my work is grounded in adult development theory, and leaders get stuck at early stages of growth, and they get so confident about their way of doing things. It's their success is the trap that they fall into. Getting past that is very difficult. You're saying to someone, you know, those famous old lines, what got you here won't get you there.
Yeah.
It's for them to realize that. That's the biggest.
So how do you, have you found a trick in creating a breakthrough moment?
Good question. So coaching a guy was just enormous. It's probably twice the size I am, a bodybuilder early in his career, a great leader, phenomenal human being. And we started coaching and created a very, very psychologically safe environment. We started doing some of the real groundwork, and I realized we weren't getting very far. Like he was listening to me in his head, but it really wasn't getting through.
Yeah.
There were so many unconscious ways of being that he got used to that had served him well and been the reason for his success that he really wasn't open. He was filtering everything through that. So I stood up and threatened to quit. I did it rather noisily.
And this is a big bodybuilder?
This is a big bodybuilder. Well, a
picture of a big hulking guy, and you're
it took some courage.
Sorry, had enough of you, yeah.
It's not like courage or stupidity, I'm not sure which. But the interesting thing was he completely broke down. Now he felt like he was being abandoned by someone that actually cared and wanted to help. He completely broke down and talked about a lot of things that were holding him back, and we made phenomenal progress after that. I could never have predicted that.
I find that to be true. It seems to be a trend I've seen with a lot of leaders like that have really strong egos. Like the way to break through them often is you have to not necessarily shatter, but break that ego, right? To create cracks in it to get to a point. Otherwise, you just reinforce it, I find.
In fact, if I may, that I think part of the challenge of your work is that there is this potential line to be crossed from the professional to the personal. And to what extent does this become a psychological session versus a leadership development session? And how do you determine how to create that safe distance, but really get at someone's necessity for behavioral change? Because it's rooted possibly in areas where you may not be able to go.
Yes, carefully. Yeah. So the way to do it carefully, you're creating a psychologically safe environment, but you're not going into the reason for a particular behavior. You may go after a particularly limiting thought pattern that they've programmed after a while, like, okay, well, anyone who's not a leader is not important or something like that, something dangerous. Those kind of damaging beliefs, you can challenge them without going into where did it come from. The questions you don't ask are, but tell me how that feels, or when did that first come about? And tell me about your dad.
The counseling questions,
the counseling questions.
What was the relationship with your mom?
Yes.
Exactly. The truth is this. If you can touch on those things, so the way I describe it is this. Most coaches will come by your house, sit out on the porch, have a really nice conversation with you, and leave. The therapist, on the other hand, will stop by, walk straight past you into the house and open all the cupboards and check them out. What I like to say I do is I'm going to come and sit on the porch with you. We're going to have a great conversation. And please understand, I will sometimes peep in the windows.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, that's very nice. I think that gives them a sense of where safety still resides.
So if I see you peeping in my windows, I'm getting coached.
So noted. Yeah, let's pull down the shades, shall we?
Is Ron out there again? Hey, so it's time for one of our segments that we like to do to mix this up a little bit. And one of our segments is called The Moral Dilemma. And so, David, take us through this.
Okay, so here's one that I would think you've witnessed, been a part of more than once. So a company says, coach up our leaders. That's a common starting point for you. And one of those leaders develops a sense of safety and trust, which we just talked about a moment ago, and says, you know what? I am so desperate to get out of here. So I need your help in me finding my next gig. And I want you to be my career transition coach through the course of our work together. Now, they're not your client, they're your coachee. So what do you do when faced with this condition? Because your client has said, coach these folks up and get them to highly effective leaders. And now one of them is saying, I want out of here.
I have one right now.
Whoops.
So that's interesting. Carefully, again, is the answer, but I'm accredited by the International Coach Federation, and the ethics guidelines are very clear on things like this. There is a veil around the conversations in the coaching arena that must be protected at all costs. However, you're being hired by and maybe even have the involvement of a sponsor, maybe from HR, maybe the immediate leader as well. So what I've done in this case is, knowing where everybody's coming from, I've spoken to HR, I've spoken to the manager, or rather listened to them. And I've spent a few sessions with this individual, and it's quite clear that he feels he might be better off out of the organization. So I'm helping him think that through. But at the same time, I'm exploring where's the company's perception of all of this and what are they looking for? And just giving enough hints and tips here and there, especially to him, like, well, you might go back to your boss and have this kind of conversation. I think you might find it fruitful. And basically keeping everybody in play so that he really does make a good decision for him. And if he does decide to leave, then certainly I will help him with that process too. But it will be done in a way that the company are working with him, not that we keep them all separate. So I try and bring things back in alignment, I guess, in any situation like that. They're always very tricky, and it must be done for the right reasons in the right way. But what I'm trying to do is say what is best for not just the individual, but for the company too.
Yeah, thank you. I know that the best coaching relationships are high trust relationships, and thus your point about the integrity and the ethics associated with that work is so critical, because someone may share with you that they feel sexually harassed. And in some cases, you know, in the human resources arena, their next step is to say, well, if you've shared this with me, I have a legal duty to act. Now, do you run across those conditions where you feel like you have a risk condition that requires some action?
So the way that's handled in a coaching arena anyway is, before the session's even started, the way that you introduce the coaching is to say, these are the limits of confidentiality. This is where it's, how it's going to work. And
so you can refer back to them.
Absolutely. And we must. And then the important thing about something like that, if something comes up with something, someone's saying, well, this has happened to me, or I'm in danger in this position, or this is where I buried the body, then there has to be disclosure. And we talk about that process too. And sometimes it can be somebody's having some very difficult home situations that are affecting all of their work. In those situations, you're saying, okay, look, I recommend you get professional help. Here's how you can do that. So there's a right way to handle all of these things.
Have you ever had to fire a client that you've worked with?
Yes, a couple of times. And that's really been driven by, this is someone not prepared to really do the work and just wants to check a box, like, I had a coach for a while, and clearly there's no benefit being taken from the relationship, and that really is not healthy. Mm. So I've curtailed those kind of agreements and arrangements.
Yeah, because I think that sometimes can feel like a bit of a dilemma there, right, where you feel an obligation, but then you have to just, you know, it's not going to work. And then another question I have for you, particularly for our listeners who might be thinking about getting a coach, working with an executive coach, especially somebody who's going to do it for the first time. There's a lot of apprehension, because I think that people hesitate to get a coach because they feel like they've got a flaw. What's your advice for those folks thinking about getting a coach?
Sure. Interesting thing is it's changed a bit, especially in the last few years. Like, most people realize now it's a positive advantage to have a good coach in your corner working with you. And the old sort of approach of, oh, okay, you only get a coach if you're on the way out the door, most of that's gone now. There's one or two cultures that hang on to that thought, but most are gone. But if you think about this in terms of the leadership trap idea, the trap is thinking that you couldn't benefit from having a third party in a safe, psychologically safe environment helping you to grow and develop. To believe that you've achieved what you're going to achieve, that you're at that level, you're competent, you're capable, you know what you're doing, basically says, in adult development terms, like, I'm done growing. Mm. And the second you do that, you can't innovate, you're not open to anybody else, you're not listening to feedback, and gradually you're going to get stuck on a plateau. So the trap there is not being open to the kind of relationships that can help you grow, whether it's a mentor, a peer, or a professional executive coach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's sometimes a fear of for folks that they've expressed to me of, what if I change and it's a shift in your identity, which is you're letting go of kind of your old you, and what is the new you going to look like? And there's a lot of fear around that.
That's interesting. A story I told earlier about the caterpillar that takes forward the whole idea of being allergic to a particular smell. So you never lose any of the skills, competencies, and capabilities you have. What you're working on is, can I get rid of some of the reactive tendencies I've got? Can I take some of the incorrect thinking that's messing me up and making me get stuck or not make good decisions going forward? How can I address those and take care of those? It's taking care of obstacles that are in your way for your own personal growth.
Mm. Yeah, this notion of coaching because someone is committed to constantly being self-reflective and looking for ways to perform at a higher level as a leader is a great positive entree into coaching. But I agree with you that we're generally beyond the remnants of coach this person up or out. But the fact is that that still does happen. And the dilemma I've found in my work is that a company may say, coach this individual. This is the only individual we want you to coach, and we're struggling with it. And I almost feel like, you know, I maybe don't even want to go there because this doesn't look like an investment in a leadership development. This looks like an obfuscation of their responsibility to work with that individual.
So let me address that because I've had that experience where someone's been sent to me and it's like up or out. And the company has clearly said, right, this is your last chance. Here's a coach, work with the coach. And they come to me rather fearful, of course, very suspicious of the whole thing. What I've managed to do several times, in fact, is create a nice, safe environment and said, look, there's a couple of ways to see this. You could definitely see this as, okay, the company is trying to squeeze you out. This is the last chance. Or if you think of it this way, the company is now open and ready to witness some change in you. Actually be ready to see a difference.
Otherwise, they wouldn't be investing.
Well, exactly. So why not exploit that? And by the way, if that doesn't work, to my earlier answer, we'll find you another job. We'll get you somewhere you should be. Yeah. So you can't lose if you're all in with this process.
Mm-hmm. Still, it's a very vulnerable condition for that individual. Okay, good. Thank you. Coaching culture. You mentioned this in the book, and I know that's part of your vocabulary as well. What do you mean when you say coaching culture?
So coaching is a way of being, if you will, rather than it's kind of a humanistic approach. Rather than trying to control and manage individuals, you're really saying everyone's got something to contribute. Let's create a safe environment where we can be more vulnerable. We can give each other more feedback to help us all grow, that we're actually owning up to, there's some things about my behavior I could change and improve. And so coaching as an approach, a way of being, and actually a way of being a leader, is a great way to approach leading anybody. So a coaching culture is one where the entire organization has been trained in how to have these kind of open conversations, how to be more vulnerable, how to encourage others, create that safe space, how to ask open-ended questions instead of just telling. So more asking than telling. And then finally, making sure you hold people accountable to what they commit to in the end. That whole approach is just so effective in any organization. Mm. So it's usually dubbed a coaching culture for that reason.
Thank you.
How did you observe that? How did you start to pick that up? I mean, and how do other leaders start to pick that up? And maybe that's some of your transition from actually working as an engineer and then moving into leadership roles.
Trying to find a short answer to this one because it's basically probably taken me 35 years to figure it out. It goes something like this. I realized after a long time, companies don't change. Leaders do. And others follow. Either willingly or they're forced, coerced, or they just leave and the whole thing collapses and starts again. Whatever happens, whatever the model is, it's like, okay, so if leaders are going to change, how does that happen? So in a lot of leadership roles my whole career, I was pushing pretty hard. I was the one telling. I had all the answers. I was the smartest guy in the room. And then one day I got some great feedback and it found its way through and I realized, oh, So actually that's managing, that's not leading at all. I went back to school and got into coaching in a bigger, meaningful way and realized, so coaching is actually the kind of tool set to help leaders change their minds. Then I read a few books. Actually, the last count's about 1,250 books.
Just a few.
Everything on psychology, brain chemistry, you name it, I was working it. And started to realize more and more and more, wow, unless there's safe space, there's no growth. So the trap is this stopping growth. The trap is getting stuck at a level where you feel like you're successful. The trap is not being open to what's going on in front of you. And the biggest trap of all is that you think you know, so start doing things automatically and you lose consciousness. You are no longer a conscious leader, aware of what's going on around you.
I see that at work when I see people come to work and the difference between folks sitting in meetings and you can tell they're just at their job versus those who are doing meaningful work. You can feel it and you can sense it, and kind of what you're saying, Ron, resonates with me when I see that.
So we record this in Austin, Texas. My sense is that you're not from Austin. Just by listening to you, there's a hint of East Texas, possibly, or
definitely East Texas.
Further east than where we are currently. So do you ever play around with your American colleagues and introduce British terms just to throw them off?
All the time. It's interesting.
When I first
moved to the States back in 1998, I moved to the Midwest. And I actually asked the recruiter, so do they still wear cowboy hats there?
It had West in the surroundings, that must be it.
Well, so I started making jokes. I thought it was very funny. I did a lot of speaking as well and realized very quickly, it's not funny at all.
Yeah, they're not landing,
I kept saying, the Queen is sending us all back one at a time, so you better make the most of each 4th of July celebration. Not seen as funny by most Americans, y'all. And my Texas accent's not got any better since I moved here 5 years ago. But in all the places I've lived in the States, including Boston for a while, although they still blame us for the Tea Party, I've found very, very different cultures everywhere I've gone. I did a lot of work in the rest of the world over the last 30 years or so as well. So what I've realized is, what's culture? Like, what's deeper than that? What's in the personality? What's deeper than that? What's in the DNA? What's just sat on top as a behavioral trait that we've just learned through habit? All of those things, all those layers are the rich place that you can find all those traps we've been talking about.
Yeah, thank you. So you have a new book you're working on for 2020.
Yeah, The Chrysalis Code is two things. It's both the title of the book, like it's leadership, knowledge into wisdom. But The Chrysalis Code, the book, is based on what I've got behind my leadership development programs and my coaching and workshops and all of that.
So they can crack the code.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And the code is this, that the tools I'm providing are sort of everything founded in adult development theory that relies upon sophisticated assessments. We can tell where you are in terms of growth and development as a human being. It includes vertical coaching, which is a very specific form of coaching to help people form a different level of mind so they can actually understand things at a different level. There's a lot of projects in there. There's a lot of workshops in there and content, all of those good things. But The Chrysalis Code, the book, is actually the story of a group of leaders at a company going through my 6-month program. And I have to say, it's the funnest thing I've ever done. It's incredible to think about individual journeys and how they all interweave. It's hilarious. And of course, I've changed all the names to protect the guilty.
Of course. Well, those are the types of books that often seem to resonate, right? Because that sort of recognizable fable that we could picture ourselves in makes the learnings that much more useful and relevant because you see it in practice in a way that, I recognize their setting, I recognize me in that setting, and I can take on some of these solutions.
Well, I hope I'm right and that my publisher's wrong because they told me you should never write a fable, nobody will buy it. So ask me again when I come back on the podcast.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, we look forward to you proving them wrong.
Yeah, I'm confident that you will.
Maybe, Ron, tell us a little bit more about the Chrysalis program, just so our listeners really understand what that means. And then you mentioned vertical, and I think a lot of our listeners may not understand what that looks like, and particularly for a lot of our listeners who are working as executives right now.
So leadership development does not have a good name for being very effective and for there being a very good measurable return on investment. That's the truth. What's happened more recently is over the last 30 years, we've come to understand how humans grow and develop. And there are actually defined stages. And there are some great luminaries in the field that have figured out what those stages are, how we can measure them. And there are a number of good assessments available, for example. Trying to help somebody move from a level to another is not something you get done in a six-month program. However, what you can do in a six-month program that's been designed that way is create the conditions for people to return to the growth edge and begin to experience more growth as a human being. That's what we're going after. So vertical is that sense of changing the way you think about things, the way you make meaning of things, whereas horizontal is more what we're used to, the kind of skills and competencies that we learn in a workshop. So if you take both together and you create the conditions where someone can really start to make different sense of things, look at things from a different perspective. Think about it this way. So a child, as they go through stages of development, can handle certain types of complex problems. And I have a couple of grandchildren, so it's wonderful to just cover my eyes and they think, you know, I've disappeared, all of that. And it's not until sometime later they start to see the world differently and they realize, oh, there's a me and I'm separate. And so the adult development takes all of that stages further. How do you create the conditions under which? Well, for children, it's pretty automatic. For adults, we keep getting stuck. So it's getting people unstuck. It's showing them the traps they built for themselves. And it's creating the conditions under which they can continue to grow in a psychologically safe environment.
How do you do that when you're working with companies? And I know your system thinks about it very holistically. And I found from having been through a lot of workshops and facilitated a lot of workshops, you're right about it. That crucial moment, it's inspiration. It changes your way of thinking. It gets you to challenge your way of thinking. But how do you sustain it? How do you work with companies to do that?
That's part of the biggest challenge. You're creating the conditions under which it can happen. You can't make it happen. But interestingly, if you create a learning environment where people feel safe, there's a lot of learning between peers, for example. So I always take an intact team through the workshops and through the experience. But it has to be individualized. I have to do executive coaching one-on-one for people to really get, well, meet me where I am and help me see what's next for me. Because at different stages of adult development, you see things differently. And very simply, one level is when you become an expert in a field. So if we think of doctors this way, they define themselves by their expertise in medicine. And many of them get stuck there. And then we start putting them in charge of entire medical organizations and wonder why we don't get the results. And what's happening is they're operating from that expert form of mind, as it's called in some models, instead of moving on to what's called achiever, which is the next one. And an achiever is someone that works with others to help get combined things done towards bigger goals, more meaningful goals. So if somebody's stuck at a particular level and they define themselves that well, then you've got to create not just new content, but new ways of doing things. You have to challenge them enough, support them enough, you know, create those conditions where they feel safe to experiment. They get support from their peers. They start to think about things differently. They take different inputs from different folks and start to believe, oh, there's maybe a bit more to this. And they start to open up for the growth. That's really what you're trying to do. And to keep it going, make sure that they're not reliant on someone like me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
pass,
key.
Pass the baton over and have them pick that up and run with it. And then they say, okay, this is great. We can do more of this. So it's that. Create the conditions and then get out of the way.
Yeah, it still surprises me how many leaders don't take a moment to establish their own system, right? And I'm having worked on the inside in these corporations, I find myself trying to create the systems. But the best leaders, and they seem to be a rare breed, put together those supportive peer networks. They work with their boss. They work with the home life. They restructure that environment.
Yeah, they define I sometimes describe it as people get stuck within the four walls of what they know. And there's a whole world of best practices out there. There are mentors that are hanging out there available to them, which allows them continue to expand in what will make them successful as a leader.
It's interesting, too, though. We almost create the problem for ourselves because we hold our leaders in such high esteem, like they've got all the answers, instead of recognizing they're human beings, they're doing the best they can, and instead of making it safe, we begin to treat them differently. So it's usually the CEO that knows least about what's going on inside the company.
Yeah.
Those kinds of things, right?
Yeah, and Chris, as you were just noting, that without the creation of one's own systems, then what Ron has earnestly done with the group, which is in essence a form of an intervention, both the group and the intervention are the individuals. You're there for a moment, and they then need to find a way to turn this on over time. So your notion of Chris creating systems for them, and I'm curious to know, are there things you do to provide them with tips and tricks that make it stick, that make the whatever they personally come up with really have a chance of sustainability?
So instead of building their trust in me, build their trust in each other. Have them realize that nobody has the answer and that experimentation is the way to go. Have them more open to feedback. I mean, in the opening workshop, I usually make them squirm by giving people some very direct feedback they've never got before. And they start to realize, oh, so this is how this is going to be, right? So they start to open up to different points of view, different ways of looking at things. They start to listen to each other. So I put together projects, so they start to work with each other, work with other people in their organization. They find new sources of new ways of looking at things. Some like to read, some like podcasts like this. Others would rather sit down and have a conversation with a peer they don't know very well. Others go looking for a mentor. So it's definitely individualized. Everyone needs an individual plan. Like, how do I build the system around for me in a way that I feel safe to continue to grow and develop and put something at risk?
So further that, sorry, do you press them to say, hey, here's a list of ways in which you can turn this on yourself and take ownership of this? Because they may feel, you're the expert, they may feel lost outside of this safe condition you've created for them, which they've done some deep self-exploration. They've committed to themselves. In that moment, they're going to take it on. But have you found that there are certain ways in which you can help them ensure that it sticks?
Yes. And I try not to use any of those because that's putting me forward as the expert, the one that knows, right? So what I'll do is offer up lots of alternatives. Or pose a question. So the workshop, quite often, we're halfway through the workshop and suddenly it takes a left turn and somebody comes up with something and I'll facilitate the process. And right in that moment, there's more learning going on than I could ever impart to those folks.
So they sort of co-architect their own solutions.
Exactly. Yeah. So offer enough alternatives, kind of like the coaching culture. Yeah. I actually teach content on how to better collaborate. What is collaboration if it's based on a masterminding principle?
Yeah.
What is influence anyway, and how can I pull that off? And they start to get very self-aware. Then they start to watch and discover what other people are doing. They start to experiment themselves. And the more I can create those conditions and the less they rely on me for that, then the more effective this is going to be long term.
I wonder what each of your responses to the maybe a more provocative view, and there's some that share this perspective, that in organizations with a hierarchy and a set of rewards and a performance system, is trust even possible, or is that kind of motherhood and apple pie?
So we create systems, don't we, to reinforce that which we think has us feeling control. So no, I mean, it's not the condition for safe growth. However, if you read things like Immunity to Change and great books that touch on this adult development theory approach, what you start to see is there are a few companies that are actually starting out very open, very vulnerable. They are taking feedback from each other. They're trying to do things in a different way. So there is a bit of a sea change going on. The challenge is the larger companies feel like they should know already. And so it's very, very much more difficult to get into an ingrained culture. Now, I'm doing some work recently on which cultures are more stuck. I do a lot of work with a bank, and I'm realizing more and more whole industries have a culture about them, and that has to be taken into account as well.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, I'd take that on from the standpoint that there needs to be a mechanism for individuals to have an understanding of where they are at any given moment. And for organizations, which are systems in so many ways, and they have their systems, for me to know where I stand in terms of my success at this moment and what the future could look like, and the extent to which I get rewarded for the impact of my work into the organization, there needs to be mechanisms for that. And they need to be fairly administered. And there needs to be highly capable leaders that are facilitating that mechanism as well. So mm-hmm. I think that it's highly necessary to have them. And then we're all about creating conditions for them to be best delivered.
Yeah, and I've found that because of the way those corporations are set up, right, that a lot of my conversations on the inside are typically comes back to about how do I get promoted? How do I get the increase? That is the goal, right? That's the individual goal that the structure has set up, which works counter to an open collaborative environment and a sense of trust because they know not everybody can get promoted, right? So I have found that as we go through a hiring coaching process, we try to coach the values, the underlying values of we know that is going to be the goal. We know that's where you're trying to achieve, but you want someone who has that core set of values of collaboration and trust in the system.
Sure. And you can certainly grow in scope, as it's referred to, right? You don't have to have a title change, but you can do more meaningful work if it's not constrained by title, by influence. And if people come to recognize that that's the environment that they're operating in, then the whole notion of this hierarchical growth with new titling along the way that ultimately are definitions of success start to reshape themselves. Mm-hmm. That's a progressive organization in action.
And a small add, if I may. So more than 25% of people that have been through the program are promoted within 12 months.
Once again, points to the fact that folks need to get the current book that's out there, which is Corporate Caterpillars. What's the subtitle here? How to Grow Wings.
Exactly.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then the upcoming one, which will be titled?
The Chrysalis Code,
yes.
Turning Leadership Knowledge into Wisdom.
And damn it, How to Crack the Code.
Exactly. Yes.
And so, Ron, as we close, parting advice, key takeaways for our listeners?
So the biggest trap when we're out there in that rough terrain, that what starts out to be a forest quickly turns to mountains, I think the biggest trap is not being fully conscious of who you are, where you are, and recognizing you have things to learn. You're on a journey, and it's not about a specific destination. It's about recognizing it's a journey and being open to the guides that are there all the way along the journey. That's what's going to avoid you falling into a trap.
So folks can find you at ronjwest.com.
Yep, that's the website. And I'm also on LinkedIn under Ron J. West. And I'd be happy to respond to anyone that has an interesting question for me to ponder.
That's great.
And J stands for, can we say this?
James, the name of my new grandson.
Beautiful.
Oh, that's good.
Thank you, Ron.
Love it. Yeah. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to the Leadership Trap. We'll see you next time.
Take care, everyone.
Thanks for listening. Do you know a leader who could benefit from hearing about the Leadership Trap? Well, then we hope you will share this podcast. And you can find us at theleadershiptrap.org. Okay, we'll see you next week. Until then, stay out of the trap.